A Waterbury man claims he was held captive for more than 20 years. His stepmother, Kimberly Sullivan, now facing charges in the case. And recently, there have been what seems like a lot of new motions in court. So we want to check in now with Sullivan's attorney. Yannis Kalaitis is here. And Attorney Kalaitis, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Glad to have you here. Can you update us with the most recent motions in court? It felt like there was a lot of action in the month of October.
Well, there was, and the one that got the most of attention, the one that everyone kind of focused on, had to do with the disclosure of medical records and the release of the accuser's new name by which he's going with, and his current address. And yep. So basically, yeah.
No, I was going to say you're correct that there are a few motions, but that is definitely the one that was making headlines.
Yeah, so and with that one, basically what happened is the state actually filed a motion seeking to preclude me and the defense team from sharing that specific information with my client. So they didn't want us to tell my client what the new alias was or what his current location is. And they didn't want to turn over the records until there was a ruling on that. So there was just a ruling on that. And basically, our objection to that, it didn't have anything to do with, she doesn't care to know this information. My client's not personally asking for this information. What the argument was over was whether the state can, or the court can require us to withhold information from our client. And we argued against that, absent a good legal basis. I believe that the origin of the request really had to do with the complainant, the accuser, simply not wanting my client to know this information. There was no legal grounds. So we expect my client to be treated fairly and the same way that any criminal defendant should be. The rule should apply equally to her. We're not going to make exceptions for people's feelings or to make someone feel comfortable. In criminal court, we need to stay focused on protecting the rights of the accused and holding the state to their burden, because these are the rights that everyone gets. And if you're ever in that position, that's what's essential.
Doesn't the state, though, Attorney Kalaitis, to some regard, have an obligation to protect the alleged victim in this case? So when you've got first responders saying he was emaciated, he was, malnourished, he was mistreated, again, innocent until proven guilty. I agree with you. But isn't it this in the state's best interest to protect this person by keeping him in hiding or basically anonymous?
They could put him wherever he wants, but he's at no danger because my client knows his address. And there's been no showing of that. There is a protective order was issued on the day of her arraignment, the first time she ever went to court. And that protective order precludes her from having any contact with him. And she's obeyed that protective order. That order is sufficient. There doesn't need to be any other exceptions or restrictions or accommodations.
Why does she need it, Attorney Kalaitis?
She doesn't need it. But as the rules of practice provide that all the defense attorneys and state's attorneys, either party has to disclose the names and addresses of their witnesses. That is in the practice book. It's in our court rules. That's one of the first things we disclose. And that information could be needed for investigation purposes. Counsel may need it to investigate where the person is. I mean, if he's at some type of treatment place, what type of treatment is he getting? What do we know about the place? There's an extensive investigation that has to be done. And the name and address is the most basic and is provided in every case.
So the name and address, totally, that I think you make a valid point there. The medical records, though?
So the medical records are essential because one thing you even mentioned, I think, going into this was his weight. I have yet to see any documentation verifying his weight. If they're going to claim that he was starved to death, close to death, malnourished, held in captivity, the medical records are essential. The medical records could provide corroboration. The medical records could provide a wealth of information. We don't know. We haven't seen them. But it's a very basic that we get the medical records. Any case that involves any type of assault, if someone claims to have been assaulted and injured, medical records are always turned over in those cases. That's just standard.
So at this point, your team does now have access to medical records, or have you've been given clearance, but have you gotten anything?
No, wait. I anticipate we'll have them soon.
Okay. So, and again, you know, to your point, Attorney Colitis, what we have at this point are, you know, certainly very, very strong accusations against your client. But we also have, like I said, you do have first responders, police, people who were on scene. That's not enough credit. You need medical records to be able to prove that alleged abuse did actually take place.
Well, I mean, I don't know that the medical records are going to prove them. They're another piece to the puzzle. And the first responders don't really shed much light on anything. What they saw when they showed up. They have no idea what happened for the 20 years before that. They have no idea whether that door was ever locked. And they have no idea why he really set that fire other than to accept what he said. You know, and people got to question that. And he set a fire to get out for a door that wasn't even locked. When he has a window looking out into the backyard where he can see other homes. Yet we've all just hopped on this. He needed to set this fire to get out.
So again, we have Attorney Colitis here who is representing Kimberly Sullivan, the stepmother of the alleged victim in this case. There were some other motions that were granted, Attorney Colitis. Could you talk about the GPS?
So we filed the motion to modify the conditions of release. The conditions of release include electronic monitoring and GPS bracelet. We asked for this to come off. The judge decided not to take it off. The judge decided to leave it on. She felt that I believe what she said on the record was that she felt there hadn't been a sufficient change in circumstances to warrant a modification of the release condition. So that stays on.
And what about access to the house, Attorney Colitis?
So the protective order, I believe, was modified at the prior court date to permit her to return to the home. So what happens in these cases, protective orders are issued at the time of arraignment. And at the time of arraignment, they listed my client's home as the complainant's home. He didn't return, and there was no intention for him to return. So even though he no longer lived there, the protective order still reflected that address. So if she was to go back to that home for whatever reason, eventually could be arrested, even though he no longer lived there. So we really needed to clear that paperwork up so that she could return to the home without fear of arrest, because that's no longer his address on the protective order. So she's permitted to return. It's her home.
Attorney Colitis, I'm curious where we're at now with the case. Obviously, as you mentioned, we've had a lot of motions. I believe there was another one that hasn't really gotten a lot of news coverage. Wasn't there one more motion?
So the accuser's counsel is present in court. And under Connecticut law, victims of crimes have certain rights in Connecticut. There was a constitutional amendment, and then there was a statute. And as a result, they have a right to be heard at certain stages of the proceeding. The constitutional amendment specifically allows them to be heard at the time of plea and at the time of sentencing. It was our understanding their counsel wanted to be heard with respect to the GPS conditions. So we filed the motion asking the court to preclude the accuser's attorney from making legal argument or addressing the court at any stage other than those specifically listed in the constitutional amendment and in the Connecticut general statutes. The court did side with us, and he was not permitted to make any argument with respect to the conditions of release or the other issues before the court.
Okay. I'm going to confess, Attorney Colitis, I'm a little lost in the weeds with that one.
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. No, listen, it's only because I'm not a lawyer. I don't understand kind of a lot of legal jargon. But what does that in layman's terms mean? Sorry.
In layman's terms, I'm trying to keep the playing field level.
Okay.
I'm trying to keep this the state of Connecticut versus Kimberly Sullivan. The prosecutor speaks for the state of Connecticut. I speak for the defense. I did not want the attorney for this accuser to come into court and argue against my motions. So I asked the judge to keep him out.
Got it.
And the judge agreed that this is between the state and the defense and would not permit his attorney to argue at this point. So for those of us that practice criminal defense, we see this often. There is a constitutional amendment for victims' rights. So in a lot of cases, there are victims, they want to be heard, or accusers, and they want to address the court. So this is just a legal argument on our part to try and keep the playing field level. And this is that's the same thing we were doing with the other motion about access to the name and address. We want to keep the playing field level. We're not going to make exceptions and make this, you know, just because it's Kimberly Sullivan and people, she's not popular and she's hated. We're not going to bend the rules. We're going to watch those rules very closely, and we're going to hold the state to their burden, and we're going to try and hold the line there. So that's kind of what's been going on.
We're talking to Attorney Kalaitis, who represents Kimberly Sullivan in the case of a man who was allegedly held captive for more than 20 years in Waterbury. So I'm curious, Attorney Kalaitis, do we have any kind of timeline or ballpark idea when your client's trial will begin?
Best guess would be sometime in 2026. I'm not too sure, but sometime next year I could see it going forward.
Okay.
It does take a while to get to trial, and things don't always move fast, but I believe that there is a desire to keep this case moving. But you know, look, I got to get these medical records, and then I got to get them some expert involved, review it. But until I have something to share with an expert, you know, our hands have been tied. So this is going to take some time, but I would anticipate a trial, hopefully before the end of next year.
Do you worry, Attorney Kalaitis, about having an unbiased jury?
Of course. Of course. I mean, that's going to be a concern. One benefit we have in Connecticut is we have what's called the individual voir dire. So we get to question prospective jurors individually, one at a time, and we get to spend some time with them. And, you know, what you want to do in that process is get the jurors talking to get an idea of where they land and what their thoughts are. So you are going to need someone who's unbiased, but you're really going to need someone that's just going to be able to keep an open mind. And think objectively and not just rush to judgment. And, you know, look, it will be hard because a lot of people made up their minds.
I asked that as well, Attorney Kalaitis, because I can already kind of tell you from a law, I'm not a lawmaker, but I do know from talking to enough lawmakers on this show that there is going to be another focus this upcoming legislative session in February of 26 on homeschooling DCF protocols, and this case, as well as the New Britain case of a young girl who was killed and was in the homeschooling, you know, population, if you will. I think this case is going to get more attention. It's going to continue to get more attention, I should say. And it's being brought up by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. So, you know, how do you factor that in as well?
Well, I'm intimately familiar with the Farmington, New Britain matter as well. What I could tell you is there's some stark differences. Ms. Sullivan's case, there was DCF involvement. DCF came to the home. They met with the child. They met with the parents. They spoke to the pediatrician. There were no issues. So I don't view Ms. Sullivan's case as a failure of DCF. With respect to the Farmington case, I'm not in a position to comment on that one yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess my question is, if this case is taken up in 2026, or the trial begins, I should say, and there's so much focus and reference to the Waterbury case as well as the New Britain case, how much more challenging does that become to find a court or find a jury that will have an open mind.
Listen, if the politicians want to, you know, use this story to for whatever their own purposes are and exploit it in the media and misstate it and make statements that are prejudicial to my client's trial rights, then that's something we're going to have to explore. Hopefully a lot of jurors aren't paying too much attention to what they have to say. So,
Attorney Kalaitis, I want to thank you for giving us the time on WICC and keeping us in the loop with what's happening. And I'm sure we'll talk again really soon.
Of course, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. That's Attorney Kalaitis here on WICC.